It was surprisingly little amount of quack because I'm
Zed's trying to quack at you. Sounds like a goat.
Quack a lot. It
sounded like a goat, dude. He's gonna miss you.
Okay, so we are going to probably try and do about half the shear on Review at Levy, finish up, and then half the shear on starting the Ramban. Okay? So, if you look at the beginning of the top page, you should have Review at Levy shear number 2 on the top. Okay, so just to bring us back to where we were last time, so there's a quote here from Harry Wolfson on a study from his work, Maimonides and Halevi, a study in typical Jewish attitudes towards Greek philosophy in the Middle Ages. So there's one quick quote, which I think just to try and bring us back to where we ended off. He says, to the philosopher, God is merely a logical necessity, a final link arbitrarily chosen to terminate the otherwise endless chain of potentiality and actuality.
That's a Halevi.
Right? So this is what Wolfson says, basically summing up the more philosophical way of approaching God, in which the point being that we take a bunch of logical rules, we put them all together, and the result is that if we don't assume that there's a God, so then we have a whole mess of these rules. We have motion, motion has to have a cause, so that cause has to have a cause, and if we don't insert God somewhere, so we have a big mess. So therefore, we assert that God must exist, because we can prove it based on these different things, so God exists. But the point is that when you do that, so all God ends up being to you is sort of a necessity based on abstract thinking and logic. So just to point out, again, we're not learning the Rambam right now. We spent a little bit of time on him. But it's not entirely fair to him because the Rambam does talk about love of Hashem. He talks about Ketzah Hi'ahava or Uya, that you become lovesick for God, like you become in love with a woman and you're obsessed with Hashem and all you want is to be close to Hashem. So clearly that the Rambam had the ability in some way to merge philosophy with a more with something that at least resulted in emotion. If it didn't come from emotion, but it resulted in experience and emotion. So this is not exactly fair, but the point has a lot to it. And the point being that Halevi, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, in the Kuzari, steers away from that. And he brings us into a place where God is not just the thing that we assert must be, because otherwise our rules of logic fall. He's not just that abstract concept that fits into this logical formula, but he's actually something personal. God is something we know and we experience, and uniquely the Jewish people have experienced God. We know God not through logic, but we know God through his revelation. God revealed himself to it. That's the key word for Yehuda Levi. The key word is revelation. Our belief in Hashem, our emunah of Hashem, comes from the fact that we tasted Hashem, that we saw Hashem. We saw things which made him known to us in a very unique way. Number one, because we experienced it, and number two, we spoke about this a little bit last week, because we have a unique ability in us as Jews, as a totally different category of being, a different class of being. There's five classes of species, not four for Yehuda Levi. We have an inyan Eloki, this divine trait, which allows us to connect and experience God in a way like no other. And we spoke about how that type of approach yields a much more powerful, love-based, and far-reaching type of connection to God. Far-reaching in the sense that he talks about that now you can understand what it means to sacrifice for God, to give up your life for God, because God is this thing which you so intimately care about because you've experienced him, not just something you prove because of a few different formulas of logic. So I just wanted to sum up that by looking at a poem from Yehuda Levi. I mentioned to you last time that Yehuda Levi, in addition to the Kuzari, wrote tons and tons of poems, and he was an amazing poet. So this poem I picked out, I think someone named there by Eitan Ben David has a shiur, a three-part series, which I recommend listening to if you're interested. You guys know him?
No.
Oh, okay. So he has a three-part series on the poetry of Rav Yehuda Levi. It's on YU Torah. I recommend it. It's very good. So I listened to just a few minutes here and there, and I looked at his sources more than actually listened to the shiur, but I listened to the shiur a little bit. Very good. And so I thank him. And this is one of the poems that he quoted. And I think it just does a very good job at summing up everything we saw. Again, I pointed out last time that the fact that he wrote poetry really is an expression or reflection of his whole approach. Because poetry is something that's more alive. It's not rigorous, formulaic, cold, logical progression. It's something that's more emotional, something that's more, it moves, it's dynamic, it captures you, it speaks to you, it resonates with you on the inside. Gets to your kishkas, right? So that's why poetry is not just, oh, he was into poetry also in addition to his philosophy, to his approach to philosophy. No. The fact that he did poetry is an expression of his approach to philosophy. It's part of the whole thing is that he had this poetry which was so alive to him.
Phenomenalism.
Yes, exactly. So let's look at this, okay? So number one. So we'll read it in Hebrew just quickly, and then we'll translate as we go along. Okay? So Ya'alat Chain Mima'omna Rechaka. Beautiful gazelle, so far from camp. Ohava Ko'es V'lamatza Chaku. Her love is angry with her. Why her laugh? Why her smile? Tzachaka al bat Edom o benot Arav. She smiles or laughs just thinking of those Edom girls. And Hagar's daughters too. Hamevakshot lachshok dod chashka. Who want to win him for themselves. Hein praim hein. You could just read the English yourselves. Vehein praim hein. Ve'ech yidmu elai. How could they compare to him? Ya'ala al hatzvi hitzparcha. Who once was road companion to the stag. E nevua, e menora, e aron habrit, e hashkina davka, e mesan ai, ai techabku ahava, ki techabku ha vihi eish nishka. Did they have the prophets? Did they have the lamp, the ark of covenant? Where did his presence lie? Oh no, my rivals, you will never put out love. Its raging flame can never die. Anyone have any idea what's going on in this poem?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah? So, yeah, what do you think?
It's that the gazelle is the Jews, the love is Hashem.
Right.
That the other nations are trying to compete, mm-hmm. right? And it's happened that you can hope to, because we have all these things. We have the tradition, we have the Masorah, we have these items that God directly gave to us. And because of that, you can never put out the love.
Oh, very good. So what's the main way that we are separate from the other people, from the other nations? I mean, how are we unique from them? What does he choose to say?
It's just to say that, do they have prophets?
Right, do they have prophets, and do they have different forms of revelation? Right, different, the ark, right, the Aron HaBris, the menorah,
it's not
right?
It's a revelation, it's a medium.
Yeah, correct, they're a medium for revelation, meaning, but that's the point, though, is that, right, and the Shekhinah,
like
right, meaning, so let's just look at it inside for anyone who didn't cop that, right, so, yeah.
It says, her love is angry with her, why her smile, is that referring to the gazelle?
I think so.
So that herb is the gazelle, yeah. Love is the Kodesh Baruch.
Yeah, but who's him? Who want to win him for themselves?
Want him, they want to win God.
They want to win God.
Oh,
they want
to
win God. Right. I mean, other nations want to win God. Meaning, right, so, you know, what does it mean that they want to win God? I'm not sure, but, right, so Ya'alach Chein, beautiful gazelle, is that he didn't make this up, right? That's we find in Nach, that like B'nai Yisrael, and we are different, you know, forms of animal. I think gazelle is like Bambi, right? It's like this beautiful, like, younger, what do you call those things? Right. What do you call those animals? Gazelles, I guess, right? But anyway, so far from camp. What's so far from camp? They're in exile, right? They're in Galus. The Jewish people, which are Hashem's beautiful gazelle, Ya'alat Chein, are so far from camp. We're so far from Hashem, from home. Hashem is, right? Hashem is angry with her. So why are we happy? Why are we enticed? Right? So again, this is classic what he's dealing with, because what did we say the subtitle of the book was?
Defense
of the despised faith. We're a faith that's despised. And what was I trying to show you? That his defense is unique. It's different than the Rambam's defense. It's different than Yossi's defense. How is it different? Because it's an internal defense. Meaning, the Rambam and other philosophy types, so they defend Judaism how? At least in the Mor Nevuchim. You could argue maybe it's different elsewhere. Maybe he's just doing it to help certain people. This is a bigger discussion. But what do they do? They defend it, and this is the Rav's Lashon, they defend Yiddishkeit by making it the handmaiden of other brilliant and other types of systems. Right? Meaning, we can defend ourselves from the attack of Greek philosophy because, no, really, we actually fit into Greek philosophy. We can defend ourselves from, you know, this is something that's very relevant to right now, let's say. We can defend ourselves from modern waves of different isms because really we are those isms. We are the same thing, just expressed in our unique way. It's the same fundamental thing. So we conform ourselves to the different tides of our age. But Rav Yehuda Levi's defense is fundamentally different. It's, no, we're autonomous. We have our own internal thing. We are not a crushed faith that we have to conform and become the handmaiden of the things around us. We have an internal, autonomous faith which doesn't need to be crushed and doesn't need to conform to other things. And that's this. The B'nai Yisrael in his time were smiling thinking of those Edom girls. I don't think it means just girls, but it means also meaning the things that are attractive of the time. And Hagar's daughters too, right? I mean, that's what we are giving into those things. Even the people that are holding on to Yiddishkeit. But they're holding on to it in a way of sort of straddling between giving in and holding on and conforming. So it's a little bit, it's losing the true authenticity, the true beauty of Yiddishkeit. But how can they vie with her? How can those other nations even compete with Klal Yisrael? Because Klal Yisrael are a totally different place. Like the Kuzari, like Halevi says in the Kuzari, he says, I don't blame people for buying into philosophy. I don't think that there's something flawed or wrong with all the things they have. Those things are excellent for a people who never got to experience Hashem. If you don't have revealed religion, then yeah, those things make perfect sense. Those are a very good option. That's the best they can do. But for us, we have Nevuah. We have the Menorah. We have the Aron HaBris. We have the Shekhinah. So what in the world are we doing even thinking that we have to conform, we have to become the handmaiden of those things? So that's the poem that I think sums up a lot of what we spoke about last week. So I just wanted to mention that. Yeah.
I don't mean to debate the philosophy, but does this in practice mean that like the Kuzari is a very right wing person who has to distance himself from modern culture because if modern culture proves an attack that he can't disprove because he doesn't argue it?
That's a really interesting question. I'm sure people. I don't know of it, but
right.
Does that lead to an isolated? Right. That's a really interesting question. I don't really have a good answer. I'm not sure. I think it is what to think. But I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's a necessary result of the things he's saying. But I definitely see how it could lead to that. Interestingly, so I think I've actually mentioned him to you before. My favorite Jewish philosophers is Franz Rosenzweig. One on my top few lists. So he, talk to you about that another time, was a person who studied Halevi a lot and was a big champion of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's approach. He really believed in it and he developed it in an amazing way. Interestingly, it's not Pashut how to understand Rosenzweig either, but interestingly, it seems to me and many other people that in Franz Rosenzweig's idea, which is a development of Halevi, doesn't mean it's true about Halevi. It is a takeoff of Halevi. That is the case. He does, and he was not like a Haredi type. He was actually barely Jewish, meaning like he was like about to become a Christian and decided to go he wanted to become a Christian in the authentic way. So to become a Christian in the authentic way means to be Jewish first. That he wasn't actually a practicing Jew. So he decided to go to Kol Nidre, and this is the story. The question of how much is true, how much is not true, definitely parts of it are true. He decided to go to Kol Nidre in a shul and he was like, wow, this is amazing, and he totally changed his mind, like forget the Christian thing. Judaism is awesome, and it's amazing. He was blown away by the experience and he fell in love with Rabbi Yehuda Levi, he fell in love with Yiddishkeit, and he, you know, so he wasn't like but he was like by no means like what we think of as like a Haredi type of person. But what seems to come out of a lot of his thought is a very sophisticated defense of the insularity of the Haredi community. I actually wrote a paper making that argument that from Franz Rosenzweig's approach. Comes out a brilliantly sophisticated defense of what is usually seen as like not such a sophisticated type of approach to whatever. Anyways, it's just an interesting thing. We're going to move on. But
very oxymoronic.
Yes, so
it's
just counterintuitive.
Judah philosopher.
Oh, so I mean the word philosopher in a more general sense. I mean, like you call existentialists philosophers, right? So, but so they were, you know, or phenomenologicalists, whatever, like the word you used before, right? So we call them philosophers, but they weren't like, you know, Greek, they weren't like rationalist philosophers in that sense. Which again goes back to what I spoke about last week about talking about Halevi as a non-philosopher or an anti-philosopher, I think is a very big misnomer. You have to understand what that means exactly. That's why I tried to parse out a little bit more last week. Okay, so moving along, the last thing I want to do in terms of, sorry, not the last thing, the second last thing I want to do in terms of how this plays out, this idea is into Eretz Yisrael. Again, so being this whole experiential approach of knowing Hashem and living Yiddishkeit through experience of God, through revelation of God, through being in interaction with God, one of the most clear expressions of this is his approach to Eretz Yisrael and his longing for Eretz Yisrael. Because Eretz Yisrael to him is not like, oh, it's just the place with more mitzvos or the place where I'm commanded to live. But what is Eretz Yisrael in its most essential? It's the place where you actually, to the highest degree, in the deepest way, you get to experience HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You get to live in that relationship. Eretz Yisrael is the chamber of chambers of the place that a Jew gets to live this most intimate relationship with Hashem.
Is it actualizing or is it literally experiencing?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Is it like how Rabban says where like it's the only place where you can probably positive performance. Those, or is it the only place where you can experience God?
I don't think it's the only place you can experience God, but it's the only place you can experience God to that degree. Meaning, if you're a Levi, thinks you can't have Nevuah outside of Eretz Yisrael unless it's about Eretz Yisrael. And you can't tap into a certain level of relationship with Hashem outside of Eretz Yisrael like you can in Eretz Yisrael. Doesn't mean you can't tap into a relationship with Hashem outside of Eretz Yisrael, but it means you can't do it in the way you can within Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so that's, we'll read a little bit. We'll try and go through it a little bit quickly because it's the same idea I've been speaking about. I just think it's important to look at a little bit of this inside. So, in section 2, remember, it was 5 essays in the Kuzari. So, it's the second essay.
Did you learn all of it?
Have I learned all of it? I've read through all of it. I wouldn't say I've learned through all of it. Same answer as I gave for Martin Vluchem. I tried to go through it quickly so I would have a general sense of what's going on the whole thing and not just like, oh, I've seen a chapter here, chapter there, but I have not learned it all well. That is for sure. So, he says in second essay, paragraph 8, the rabbi, meaning... Right, Halevi says, even so, does the glory of God, which is only a ray of the divine light, benefit his people in his country? So says the king, I understand what you mean, what thou meanest by his people, but less intelligible is what thou sayest about his country. I'm going to drop this annoying English. Meaning, what does the king respond? He responds, okay, I understand what you're saying, that there's uniqueness to the people, because that he explained already, like we saw last week, but what do you mean that there's uniqueness to the country? Yeah, people live in a country because that's where the people, you know, get together and make social pacts and different things. But what does it mean that there's this uniqueness to the country? So says the rabbi, 10. Thou will have no difficulty in perceiving that one country may have higher qualifications than others. There are places in which particular plants, metals, or animals are found, or where the inhabitants are distinguished by their form and character, since perfection or deficiency of the soul are produced by the mingling of elements. Says the king, yet I have never heard that the inhabitants of Palestine were better than other people. Answers the rabbi, how about the hill on which you say the vines thrive so well? If it had not been properly planted or cultivated, it would never produce grapes. Priority belongs, in the first instance, to the people, which, as stated before, is the essence and kernel of the nations. In the second instance, it would belong to the country, on account of the religious acts connected with it, which I would compare to the cultivation of the vineyard. No other place would share the distinction of the divine influence, just as no other mountain might be able to produce good wine. Follow what he's saying? He gives a mashal. In many different countries, in different places of the world, you have unique characteristics or traits or qualities in the ground, in the air, in the different factors in that place, in that geographical location, that yield a superior version or superior produce of a certain type. So some places will have a better resource for growing this type of grain, and some places will have a better resource in terms of developing this type of metal, and all these different things throughout the world. So what is Eretz Yisrael unique in? That it has the characteristics that allow a person to attach himself to the divine influence the most, that allow a person to experience the revelation the most. That's the uniqueness of Eretz Yisrael. In this land that we're so fortunate to be sitting in right now, there's a quality which brings forth HaKadosh Baruch Hu's revelation and brings us to a higher place to create a rendezvous with that revelation, with that being, to create an intimate connection, an experience, a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Dafka in Eretz Yisrael, it's a place that you have the unique characteristic, the unique qualities to allow for that, to bring that out. And then he says, which I mentioned to you before in 14, whoever prophesied did so either in the Holy Land or concerning it. Meaning there's no such thing as Nevuah, at least a certain level of Nevuah, outside of Eretz Yisrael, unless it's about Eretz Yisrael. Because again, of this quality that inheres in the land. In section 4, the same thing, 17, this in the fourth essay. He is also called God of the land because this possesses a special power in its air, soil, and climate. There's a special power that's here. Automatically, by us being here, we are already in a different connection, a different pipeline of connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which in connection with the tilling of the ground, it sits in improving the species. And in section 5, the very end of the book, the conclusion, so what happens? I told you this in the beginning. What happened to the rabbi afterwards is that he decided to leave Khazaria to go to Jerusalem. The Kizer king was very upset about his departure and spoke with him about it. He said to him, what do you seek today in Jerusalem in the land of Canaan? The divine presence is gone from these places. Meaning, everything you told me before, fine, I accept that, but that's not true anymore. Maybe when there was a base of Mikdash, maybe when there was Nevuah, maybe when there was all these things, but not now. Closeness to God can be achieved in any place if you have a good heart and a strong desire. Why then should you place yourself in danger from deserts, oceans, and various people? Says the rabbi, only the divine presence which was seen by the prophets with their own eyes is God. Nevertheless, the land of Canaan is especially reserved for the God of Israel, and one's deeds cannot be entirely complete in any place except there. Many commandments are not practical for one who does not live in Eretz Israel. Furthermore, one's heart and soul cannot be entirely pure and refined except in a place which one knows is especially reserved for God. As we said. And we'll just finish off this section with a poem again, just to show you another aspect of his contributions about Eretz Yisrael. We'll read it in English. Your bride is coming out to meet you, longing, heartsick, since the day she first was barred from visiting your sanctuary. Each time of pilgrimage, she gazes, shamefaced, at the strangers who have made the journey while she has not. He's talking about himself, right? He's saying, your bride, me, to Hashem, I'm coming out to meet you. I'm longing for you. I'm lovesick for you. Since the day I was cast away from your sanctuary. She stands far off in all the places of her exile, bowing toward your temple, your holy temple, right? When we daven every day, even in Golos, we're always facing Eretz Yisrael. So I have it in my mind all the time, sending prayers instead of sacrifices, no more karbanos. Lifts her heart and eyes towards your throne. I'm always thinking of where to you, directing myself to you. Look down at her from heaven. Hear the cry. She cries with bitter heart and yearning soul. His longing for Eretz Yisrael is an emotional longing. It's an experiential longing. It's a longing for a relationship, for the rekindling of this relationship. Okay, so this concludes basically the main idea I wanted to look at from the Kuzari. The last thing I want to look at is just quickly outside. I'm not going to do it inside. It is what his proof of mass revelation, which is sort of the underpinning of this whole thing that we spoke about. But before we do that, I just want to give a 1 second chizuk based on the ideas we just said. That I know for a bunch of you, and if this is true for you, if not, it's still meaningful either way. But if I know for a bunch of you, this is the last few weeks or last month or so in yeshiva, right here in Eretz Yisrael, right, and going back to America to go to college and yeshiva of different sorts. And I would just encourage you to reflect on the things we just spoke about in relation to your last amount of time here in yeshiva. You know, when you think about it, why do you think that it is that yeshiva had the year in Israel, as it's called, right? The year in Israel. For you guys, thank God, more than 1 year. But the year in Israel has this effect on people, gives people the opportunity to develop themselves in a deeper way and connect with Judaism in a new way and enhance their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with Torah, with themselves, the Chule. So I think a large part of it is obviously a lot of factors, but I think to me, the most fundamental factor in why that is the case is because of everything we just spoke about right now. Is because in yeshiva, in Eretz Yisrael, living in yeshiva, living in a place that the Beis Medrash is where you spend most of your day, that it's a few minutes away, it's a few steps away from your dorm, that you're in Eretz Yisrael, that you're surrounded by Rebbeim, you're surrounded by different people who are connected. So then Yiddishkeit isn't something that, Torah and mitzvahs aren't something that's just hearing, like, oh, this is what you're supposed to do, this is a nice idea, this is a good thing, I should do this, I should do that, I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't do that. But it's actually something that's alive, it's something that you're experiencing, something you're tasting. You're just thrown into everything we just spoke about. You're thrown into the middle of this whole thing going on. Right? It's like, before you come to yeshiva, almost, it's like trying to explain to someone, whatever your, I don't know, your favorite sport is, yeah? So let's say hockey, football, let's say, right? Trying to explain to someone why it's such an awesome, awesome thing to watch, why it's so fun, exciting, and enjoyable. Or music, you love music. Trying to explain to someone who has never heard music. Right? Trying to explain to someone, lo and lo, to someone who's deaf, the beauty of music. You can't really explain it to them. The only way they can really understand its depth and its beauty and its richness is by actually listening to it, actually watching it, actually being in it. Not just from afar, but seeing it up close. The revelation of it to that person. Not just as a form of logical proofs and of ideas and of do's and don'ts. And the time in yeshiva is the time that you have that the most. And I hope it doesn't stop after going back to America. You have to find ways that that's going to continue. And there are an amazing number of ways that can continue. and should only go more and more and more. Yeshiva is one of the fatal mistakes, right? But your year in Israel shouldn't be the climax. It should be the beginning. The beginning, which is a high that you can always look back on for inspiration. Because in a certain sense, it is a high that you might not ever reach again. But it shouldn't be the high. It should be something that's motivating you in the future. But the uniqueness of it is exactly what we just spoke about. The uniqueness of it is that it's something alive for you. It's something like poetry. Not just like philosophy, if I may. So take advantage your last time here. And what does it mean? What do I mean when I say take advantage? I mean throw yourself in even more. Just plunge in even further. If you're 10 feet underwater, go 20 feet underwater. Just for your last little bit. Because these are precious minutes of being able to taste something firsthand, not just from afar. Okay, so with that said, let's continue. I just want to talk about... Are we all good? Yeah? Okay. So, it's late. We'll do a little bit of an abridged version tonight. But we're good? We'll keep going. Okay. So, let's just do an outside version of Rabbi Yehuda Levi's famous proof for everything we believe in, basically, which is based on what's known as mass revelation. Okay? So, basically, it goes like this. I'm just going to do it very quick. I hope I do a decent job at it. Basically, it goes like this. We believe in Hashem, we believe in Torah Misinai, because Hashem revealed himself to us. Do you mind closing the door? Sorry, I need to concentrate a little bit for this, and I'm just getting a little, sidetracked. So,
permission to believe.
Yeah, does he speak about it?
Yes.
Okay, fine. So you guys should just read it in there if I don't do a good job. But basically, so, we believe, or we're told, right, that something happened in history. Yeah? A revelation, an event of crazy proportion and significance happened in history for real. Not just figuratively, it really happened. Now, there's two possibilities you can go when you hear something like that. You could either say it happened, or two, you could say it didn't happen, and someone convinced people that it did happen. Okay? Now, those are the only two possibilities, right? Because tons of people believed it for ages and ages, right? For tradition and on and on and on. So there's only two ways to deal with that, really. Either you could say, okay, so it must be that it did happen, that's why tons of people have believed it throughout history. Or that it didn't happen, and someone convinced the people it happened. Okay, so now let's assume the side that it didn't happen. And someone just convinced people that it happened. Okay, so what I'm going to show you now is that that's an absurdity. That, the fact that that's an absolute absurdity, will then result, reductio ad absurdum, that the other possibility is the correct possibility, because it'd be another choice, and therefore we can believe in it with full proof. Why is it an absurdity to say that it didn't happen and someone convinced 600,000, if not more, people, or large groups of people, all our ancestors, tons of people throughout history, that it happened? Why is that an absurdity, if it didn't happen? So the reason it's absurdity is because you can't convince an entire nation of people that an event happened to them that didn't actually happen to them. Okay? You can convince people of an event that I say, it happened to me, and you should believe me that it happened to me. So now, you would probably, if you were really like a really penetrative thinker and, a skeptic, so you would want to know, why should I believe you, okay, etc., etc. But, theoretically, I can understand why you would come to the conclusion that maybe you'll believe me. But if I tell you something happened to you, not something happened to me, I tell you something happened to you, and you don't know about it, right? Meaning you're standing, you're hearing that this thing happened to me, but you don't actually know about it ever happened to you. You don't think it ever happened to you. The only source of the fact that it happened to you is because I'm telling you it happened to you. So if the only source of it, you thinking it happened to you, is because I'm telling you it happened to you, you would have to be a complete moron to believe that it happened to you. Okay? So I'm just going to read you a quote of someone who I think summed it up pretty well. The outline of the refutation of the second alternative proceeds as follows. Listen closely. Imagine someone making up the story and trying to sell it. He's going to come to a group of people, and he's going to tell them that sometime in the past, their ancestors stood at a mountain and heard God speak. He's not talking about a people in China or Tibet. He's talking about the ancestors of his audience. He is claiming that God revealed himself to all of their ancestors simultaneously, and by doing so, founded a new religion. Okay, that's the story. Theoretical story. What's the question with which the audience will confront him?
Why did my grandparents?
The obvious question is, if this happened to our ancestors, how is it that no one knows about it but you? What happened to the memory of that event? Everyone simply forgot it? They were more interested in the soccer scores? That's what this person inserted here. No one told us about it. The whole religion just disappeared. It is simply not credible to tell an entire nation that their collective ancestors witnessed such an earth-shattering event and that it was forgotten. It would be impossible to explain why the memory of the event disappeared. Therefore, says the Khuzari, the person inventing the story and trying to sell it will never succeed. To give you a simple parallel, suppose someone told you today that 500 years ago, gold grew on trees throughout Romania. Gold grew on trees for 20 years, and then there was a blight that killed all the gold trees. Would you believe it? Would you have to go to an encyclopedia and look up Romanian history? I don't think you would need to investigate the history of Romania. If such a thing happened, you would already know about it. It would have been so spectacular that everyone would know about it. The books would be filled with it. Novels would have been written about it. There would have been a botanical research project to find out what happened to the gold trees and how to reproduce them. It's not the kind of thing people forget. This is from a website called Morasha Syllabus. They have an excellent piece on this whole thing. You think you heard this? So now what's the obvious response you might want to make to this? Is that, but don't we see that other religions did exactly this, right? There's tons of people in the world now that believe that something happened to other random people throughout history that therefore created no religion. So we see this whole thing's wrong because you can have this phenomenon occur. So the obvious answer exactly is, the obvious answer is that the difference is that they were telling them that God appeared to me, as opposed to saying that God or the prophet, right, appeared to you. And not only to you, but to a mass of people, not just to one person. Right? So, again, quoting. What, on the other hand, is Judaism based on? The Jewish claim is that the entire Jewish people, every single man, woman, and child living years ago, had Moshe personally verified to them by God as they stood at the base of the mountain. This claim of revelation on a national level is actually the exact claim which we would have expected every other major religion to make. This is also another interesting way of looking at it. Not in hindsight, but in predictive. Right? Meaning, if you would predict how it would make sense for something to spread. What Judaism claims, and being the only religion, at least I think, that claims this, is actually exactly what you would expect. The other things are things that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be.
I wouldn't expect that because it's so hard to get away with, especially now.
Exactly. Exactly. Meaning, it's so hard to believe in, if it's not true, that's why you expect it to be the actual source of something that's true. Exactly.
Much easier to believe.
You want to say it, so I'm going to slug it up.
I like that.
I'm joking.
A little bit stupid.
This claim of revelation on a national level is actually the exact claim which we would have also expected every other major world religion to make. This is because it is the only claim which a reasonable person could possibly deal with. Why is it, in fact, unique to Judaism is a question which clearly demands an explanation. And what's even more amazing about this, and this is something that whoever wrote this on Marsha Silva has pointed out. Listen to this. Maybe you haven't heard this before. Even if, Mar, you think you've heard this proof of that, it's not. Maybe it's something new for you. Listen. Okay? So this is amazing, is that this actually, I never saw this pointed out before. The Torah says that this should be our proof. The Torah says this in Dvarim. What does it say? It's the last thing on your sources here. Look at the psukim. I personally never heard this before. I've heard the Mass Revelation thing before. I never noticed this. I think this is just amazing. It says, Dvarim Perek Dal, Pasuk Lamed Beis. So this is talking about when Bnei Yisrael will be scattered throughout Galus. So then it says, Ki sha'al na liyamim rishonim, asher hayu lefanecha lemin hayom asher bara elokim adam al ha'aretz, lemekzeh ha'shamayim, ba'akzeh ha'shamayim haniyah kadavar ha'gadol hazeh o'anishma kamohum. Ask. Meaning, inquire, look into all the days, into history, throughout the world, since God created man, across the universe, and ask, has there ever been a claim to the claim that we claim? Has there ever been anything? Kadavar hagadol hazeh, or hanishma kamohu. Hashama am, has a nation, a mass of people, heard, kol ha elokim midaber mitocha ish, kasher shamata, like you heard, not your aunt, you heard, akav yechid. Has there ever been anything like that? Oh, hanisa elokim lavo lakachas lo goy migarev mikarev goy. B'mosos u'b'osos b'masos b'osos u'b'mofsim u'b'melchama b'yad chazaka b'zoran tuya b'morim v'chule. Like Hashem did for you Mitzrayim. Has there ever been a nation that saw with their own eyes such miracles being predicted beforehand to the T with such consistency to take them out? Atah har eisa ladas ki Hashem hu elokim eino mevado. And he goes on. And what I think is awesome, we'll get back. So, one sec, we'll get back to this, okay? So, this is exactly what the Torah says, right? And predicts. The Torah says, the Torah predicts, or actually guarantees, but that there will never be another people to make this claim. And that has proven right. Why is it that there's never been another people to make this claim? Because you can't make this claim if it's not true. So that's his proof, al rego achas.
People had a tradition, like any other culture at the time, and because... You know, that also doesn't explain why that's popular and all the different things. You can't explain that. So I'm saying, in theory, that there was a group of Israeli tribes, people living in Israel, mm-hmm. They dominated the land, and they were a little saying, in order to validate the oral tradition didn't come second, it came first. Okay. The written tradition was only redacted at a later point to prove more validity to the oral tradition. Like, people have said, the written tradition and the oral came second, but I think in this whole construct of oral is what existed. All the minute weird practices, you know, in biblical stuff, and the written tradition was written down as a means to justify those things, perhaps for a number of reasons. And that couldn't have been questioned by people. First of all, because that happened much later. And if in the society,
no, but that's what he's saying. How would that have ever possibly happened unless these people were a massive group of morons?
Nobody was literate. Who was?
Forget literacy. What does literacy have to do with anything?
Nobody had access.
If
to
you're
beyond their
listen,
form.
If you're, if listen, do you think? Let's just say.
Can we
yeah.
Not, like, do this on the Torah now.
You want to go on? Okay.
Yeah, it's really fun. Like, this doesn't need to go on.
Okay.
Oh, is this why I started recordings?
No, okay, you are. Don't worry. I've only said Mara's name. I haven't said your name. Don't worry. We can take
I
it off.
I said.
We could delete this part if you want. Don't worry. I will not post anything anyone's uncomfortable with. Okay, let's start the, what?
Really, you want to...
It's not right. It's not right.
Yeah. Rob Short.
It's not to YU, and it's not right.
Oh, yeah.
Pick up that one.
Right. Okay. It's complete jugger. It's not right. The charedim is not good with it.
All right. Let's start the Ramban, okay?
This must be all deleted.
I'm actually going to only put up these 2 minutes. It's going to be titled like Kuzari Ramban. Only these 2 minutes.
Can I say a quick joke? I think yes. So in the Gush, where Chef had a Q&A, and they asked him, if you change one thing about why you won't be. Your classes don't need to be taught by Abby Corson. And then my friend Ed Jordan, and I was like, he's like, that's a joke. He said the same thing about Gush.
That must be taken off also. Better to come and kill you. Yeah,
okay. So let's look at the Ramban a little bit, yeah? I think I gave a sheet to that also. Alright.
Okay.
So
we have the sheets.
Okay,
Ramban. Ramban was his name was Moshe ben Nachman. He lived from 1194 to 1270. He lived in Girona, Catalonia, and Spain, and he eventually died in Eretz Yisrael. His Rabbeim were Rav Yehuda ben Yakar, in that was in Gemara, and in Kabbalah he learned from Rabbeinu Azriel and Rav Ezra of Gerona, who were students of Rav Yitzchak Sagi Nahor, Isaac the Blind. This is like the massive tradition of Kabbalah, one of the massive schools of Kabbalah. Sorry? He was a massive Mekubal. There you go. He practiced medicine for a living, so that he wouldn't have to be supported by other people in his learning. That's what they say. I don't know. He studied philosophy. He started writing when he was 16 years old. One of the unique things about him, in terms of his writings, was his tremendous respect for those before him. Like, he wrote Pirushim, even if he didn't agree with the people, like, let's say the Rif, for example. He didn't always agree with the Rif's opinion on things, but he wrote Pirushim on Shas to defend the Rif from the Baal Ma'or, from the Ravid, even if he didn't even necessarily agree with the Rif. People point that in other places where you see this sort of theme, how he had, like, he cared a lot to sort of hold up tradition and the earlier authorities. Some speculate that maybe this had to do with the time, meaning that since it was a time of sort of more philosophical trends catching on, so people were more flippant about, you know, oh, we know better and we can, you know, start using reason to develop, you know, better ideas, and we can be a little bit more flippant with earlier tradition, so maybe that's what impacted him to have this. Maybe it was actually just, you know, more internal, and he actually had this type of kavod for Masorah. Okay. So he was not really a believer in the Marn Vilchim. He was not a fan. But he was not a fan of those who basically, like, you know, excommunicated the Rambam and did, you know, and burned or did things like that. And he was sort of actually a peacemaker in what's known as, I think this is the second Maimonidean controversy, right? I think this is the second, whatever. He was actually one of the peacemakers in this, in the sense that he defended attacks on the Rambam by sort of showing the Rambam's godless in Mishneh Torah and holding up the Rambam's godless as a Torah scholar. And he made peace by, on the other hand, sort of giving interpretations to the Marn Vilchim, which is debatable, but he argued that the Marn Vilchim was really written only for people who, you know, needed some help in figuring things out. But not really, this was like the ikker thing for people to learn. And he did not advise learning the Marn Vilchim. He actually said not to learn it. But, right. So he actually did not advise learning it. He thought you should not learn it. But at the same time, he sort of was a peacemaker in terms of the Rambam and the controversies at the time. He wrote a tremendous amount. Like, it's absurd what this man produced. It's absurd. So, I don't know in terms of, like, quantitatively what adds up, but he wrote, I mean, Rashi is all very, like, you know, little bite-sized things, but he wrote, like, just tons. It's crazy. So, I'll just give you a few. He wrote a Perush al Torah, which actually came at the end, but he wrote Chidushim on Shas, on a ton of Shas. Which are considered like just, you know, the most brilliant, you know, peyushim of a chidushim of any rishon we have on Shas. He wrote something called Kuntras Dina Degarmi. He wrote, sorry, Kuntras Dina Degarmi. I mean, it's also really just chidushim on Shas, but it's a separate Kuntras, which Dina Degarmi is a sugya in the Zikin about damaging in a more indirect way. So he wrote this whole Kuntras on Dina Degarmi. What'd you say? Yes, he wrote Torah Adam. He wrote Mechamos Hashem, which is defense of the rift from the Baal Maor, Sefer HaZuchus, which is defense of the rift from the Ravid. He wrote Igeres HaKodesh, which is about marital relations and understanding the body, sort of, I think, against the Rambam's Mahalach on those things. He wrote Shar HaGmol, comes at the end of something else, of Hilcho, of Sefer Geula, maybe, Shar HaGmol. Okay, of Torah Adam. In Torah Adam, Shar HaGmol is like the last chapter, which is about the eschatology, Chias HaMesim and Mashiach and things like that. He wrote Torah Adam, which is Halachos of Avelos and mourning and death and different things like that. He wrote Hilchos Nida, Mishpatei HaChirem, about excommunication. He wrote Hilchos Brachos, Hilchos Chala, Hilchos Nedarim. He wrote Hasagos on the Rambam, Sefer HaMitzvos. He wrote Igeres HaRamban. I mean, that's not a big work, that's like the famous little letter, though, to his son, as like probably did it, like, you know, as a side. What do you say? But yeah, and then he has the famous Sefer Vikoch, which I'm going to get to in a second. So basically, it's just...
Did he also have the Sefer Mitzvot?
Yeah, Hasagos on the Rambam, Sefer Mitzvot. Yeah, I mentioned that. So, I mean, it's, and this is not everything. It's just unbelievable what this man came out with. But to me, what's most unbelievable, which is what I love so much, is that he functioned on so many different levels, which you see in all the Sfarim. Meaning, the best example of that is the Perush HaTorah, which I'll get to a little bit more later. But meaning, he was a mechadesh in Gemara, in understanding Gemara in incredible depth, and Bekiyas and Iyun. I mean, wasn't really working with those, that's like those are our terms, but meaning it was all just one for him, and then, and that's like a modern thing. But meaning, just his Bekiyas is unbelievable, and his Iyun is unbelievable, that's all I mean by that. He was a halachist, he was a mekubal, and he was a mefarish ala Torah in terms of text, and in terms of like exegesis. He was just, and he functioned on all these levels. And his works, and specifically his Perush al Torah, brings it all to bear. Meaning his Perush al Torah, you see that he has al derech hapshat, al derech hasod, al derech haemes, liyodechein. He's quoting from the Gemaras, he's quoting from Sefer HaBahir, from Sefer Yetzir, which are mystical works he's quoting from. It all comes together in the Ramban. It's just like overwhelmingly just astounding what this man was. Astounding. So just a quick story that I think really speaks to this point is, there's a famous story that someone once asked, I know that he says this all the time, so it's not like you need a story for it, but I'll tell you in the story form that I heard once, that someone once asked of Aaron Lichtenstein at a question and answer session, what should I do to become a Talmud Chacham to be a Talmud, to be Talmud Chacham, not, you know, but just to be holding, to really know stuff, to know my stuff in 2 years. I want to be holding in 2 years. What should I learn? What should my approach be? So Rav Aaron said you should learn the Ramban al Torah, the Perush Ramban al Torah. Why? Because the Perush Ramban al Torah, you get a taste of everything. You get Gemara's brought in, you get Pshat of Chumash brought in, you get a little bit of Kabbalah brought in. You get it all there. It's all there. He just had it on his fingertips and it all came together. And he functioned on all these various levels. And it's just unbelievable. So I'll just tell you very quickly the story of his famous debate with Pavel Christiani. Then we'll look at just like a piece or two very quickly for a few more minutes, and we'll wrap up. Okay, does that sound good to everyone?
Sure.
Okay. So his famous debate with Pavel Christiani, who was sent, he was you know, an apostate Jew, I think, right? He was sent by the king to have. Well, he sort of persuaded the king to whatever, a whole thing. But he basically was going to argue with the Ramban. There were like all these accusations against Jews, these libels against Jews at the time, and Jewish beliefs and things like that. And he was going to force the Ramban to defend the Jews. He thought he would win because he thought that the Ramban couldn't actually be honest because it would be too dangerous to say the true beliefs. So the Ramban would be scared, and he would end up destroying the Ramban, and then the Jews would go down the drain. What ended up happening is the Ramban came against his will. He didn't want to do this, but he came. And he, listen, I'm no like good historian. This is just like the simple version of it. You know, I'm not sure, whatever, so just a disclaimer. But the Ramban came, and he asked for permission from the king to be honest, intellectually honest, and say the truth, and the king granted him permission. So what ended up happening is that the Ramban completely dominated, and you know, they sort of wanted to stop, but the king wanted to hear more, so he just like made the Ramban continue. It was like a 4 or 5 day debate, and after like a few days, it was just like it was going in a wrong direction. The Jews wanted him to stop because he was doing so well, and they thought, they were nervous that the non-Jews would end up, you know, being so upset that they were made a fool of, and they would, you know, pogrom and things like that against them. But the king made him keep going, and at the end, the king gave him like 300 something of gold, whatever, out of respect. And he said to the Ramban that he's never encountered a man so wrong, but so well argued. He obviously couldn't admit to the Ramban, but he admitted of his brilliance and how well argued he was. What ended up happening is that the non-Jews claimed victory. They pretended that they won. And it was a whole, you know, a whole thing. It wasn't so good for the Jews. The Ramban ended up publishing this as a text called Sefer HaVikuach, and which I think we still have. And what happened was that Pablo Christiani took passages from it, which made Jews look really bad, and he brought it to Christians and basically blasphemed against the Ramban and tried and brought him to sentence him for death. They took him to the king. The king knew the truth. The king was there for this whole thing to happen. So he couldn't, you know, let the Ramban off scot-free because he had to be loyal and, you know, he had to whatever. But he didn't want to sentence him to death. So he sent him to exile for 2 years. Eventually it turned into an exile for life. And because of this, the Ramban made Aliyah. The Ramban went to Eretz Yisrael and went to Yerushalayim. I think it's a little bit of a debate, but I think a lot of people say that the Ramban shul that we still have now was established by the Ramban. At that time, Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim were like in shambles in terms of Judaism. There was nothing going on. It was like absolutely nothing. What do you say?
Well, mid-second crusade.
You guys know better than me. I'm so bad at history; it's embarrassing. So, anyways, So he went to Yerushalayim, and it was just horrible. And he sort of revived things. He sort of, I mean, not really revived in like a significant way, but he did a little bit. He started getting things going a little bit. One of the things I think a lot of people say is they're in Ramban Shul, which is pretty cool, right? It's like they say it's like one of the second oldest shuls in Eretz Yisrael. I mean, I'm sure like the design of the building's not the same one, but I think they.
Like, there, but he didn't live in Yerushalayim.
Uh huh. Oh yeah, okay. So I think it's a debate where he's buried, and one of the places might be that. But you think that's where he lived also? Okay, I could be wrong. I'm not. I'm definitely by no means. So
I think so.
And that's what they say. I mean, not what anyone says, but yes, exactly. So, anyways, I'll just read you a little quote that he wrote, just so we open up the person of the Ramban, because when you get to know this the person, it's more meaningful. So far, it's just been like stats, like, you know, it's almost like a highlight reel. But just a little quote, meaning showing he was a person also. He wrote when he was in Eretz Yisrael, which was, in a sense, exile for him. In a sense, it was home for him, right? But it was exile from his family. And he wrote, what'd you say?
His family didn't go.
His family didn't go. He was there alone. So he wrote, I left my family. That's when he wrote the letter in Geras Ramban to his son, was from there. He wrote, I left my family, I forsook my house. There with my sons and daughters, the sweet dear children I brought up at my knees, I left also my soul. My heart and eyes will dwell with them forever. He was very sad, he missed his family, you know. So you see, you know, it's just nice to get a sort of a window into the person he was. He was a person also. So anyway, that's the background of the person of the Ramban, the sort of the highlight reel that we can now approach, trying to learn a little bit from him. Okay, so we'll just do a few minutes, and then we'll probably do one more share on him, and then move on. So we're going to mostly learn his Perush al Torah. One of the things we'll see introduced, not that we're probably not going to really go into it to try and explain it really, which we'll sort of see why. But he was a Mekubal. Right, and he brought a lot of Kabbalah to the table. As we said, he was a student of Rebbeim of Kabbalah, and we'll see what that means in a second, as how important that was for him. The Kabbalah of Baal Peh, not the Kabbalah of Bechsav, but two major Kabbalistic works that of like ancient Kabbalah that the Ramban quotes all over the place are Sefer Yetzirah, as did the Kuzari. Levi also quoted from Sefer Yetzirah a lot in Kuzari, and Sefer Habahir. He refers to Sefer HaBahir in the words Midrasho Shel Rabbi Nechunya. He won't call it Bahir. That's what people nowadays call it. But in the Ramban Al-Torah, when you see Midrasho Shel Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana, that means Sefer HaBahir. Because Sefer HaBahir starts off with, I think, Amar Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana. So, the unique thing about his Kabbalah in regards to his Perush al Torah is that before him, what he did wasn't really done. What am I referring to? That he brought Kabbalah as an interpretation of the text of the Torah Shebichsav. Meaning you have in earlier Kabbalistic works, like the Bahir and Sefer Yetzirah, you know, for sure in Bahir, I think you have, I'm not sure about Sefer Yetzirah, I've never seen much of Sefer Yetzirah. Sefer Bahir, I've seen a little bit. You definitely have quoting psukim and giving explanation of them, Kabbalistic explanation of the psukim. But it's not like Al HaTorah. The Ramban takes Kabbalah and puts it al HaTorah. He gives explanation of the psukim, what he calls al derech ha'emes, or sometimes in different words, with Kabbalistic ideas, that the words are actually referring to Kabbalistic ideas. You don't really have that before him. Interestingly, I personally find this fascinating, is that that's what the Zohar ends up doing also. But the Zohar wasn't really known yet at that time. So it's just very interesting that the Zohar ends up doing that also. The Zohar ends up being, you know, a lot on, not entirely, it gets on, you know, massive tangents, like crazy, like nothing I've ever seen before, the amount of tangents, but, and like you know, random obscure things. But it is Alpi Seder HaParshios, and it does that. I mean, you know, whatever, it's not clear, because how did it become Seder HaParshios, meaning Zohar is really a Torah Shebaal Peh, which ended up getting put together the way we have it now. So, whatever. It's not really clear. But anyway, this is an interesting anecdote. Side point. But that's what he does, which is very interesting. Now, the first thing I want to speak about in terms of his Kabbalah, which is very interesting and important, is he was possibly the most hardcore esotericist, meaning secret person, of Kabbalah. More than his Rabbeim and more than his Talmidim. Who were all Mekubalim. Actually, his Rebbeim and Talmidim were amongst those who sort of broke the chain of being so secret about Kabbalah. And the Ramban and other people, the Ramban and Rav Yitzchak Sagnar, both sort of reprimanded them for doing so, but they still did it. They thought it was right. But interestingly, both before him, the people he learned from, and the people who learned from him, didn't really abide by this. But he was hardcore in the fact that Kabbalah is a secret, and that you cannot understand Kabbalah al pi svara, meaning you can't figure out Kabbalah principles and Kabbalah ideas through logic or reasoning. Not that they're illogical, not that they don't make sense, but I mean, you can't come to them on your own. You can only have true Kabbalah if it's a Kabbalah, which means, well, it's received, meaning you got it from a teacher. Okay? So the Kabbalah he writes in his Perush al Torah is very, very terse. Right? Very few words, he doesn't really explain it ever. And he writes explicitly in the Hakdamah, the first thing I want to look at together. Look here. The Hakdamah of Perush al Torah. V'chol hanimsel Moshe Rabbeinu v'shari habina. One second. Sorry. I just totally ruined the energy of that. Give me one second. Yeah, right? I just killed that. shoot, where is this? Oh, okay. So look at the, you see in the first section of the things I bring, the last paragraph before the second bolded koteret, right? So the three dots. Ani hinani mevi bevris ne'emana. See that, guys, here? Ani hinani mevi bevris ne'emana. V'hi hanu senes eitza hogenes l'chom mistakel v'sefer hazeh. I'm about to tell you a very important piece of advice for anyone looking at the sefer. Leval yizbor svara. Don't come up with a svara, with an idea. Va'al yachshuv machshavos b'dvar mikol harimazim asher ani kosei b'sisrei haTorah. Don't try and figure out anything of what I'm writing with Sisrei haTorah. Ki ani modio. This is the most interesting part, I think. Because you might think, okay, fine, he said not to try and figure it out. Okay, but I'm a chutzpahnik, I'm going to try and figure it out because I want to know. I'm not going to listen to him. But this is the kicker. Because he says, ki ani modio, because I'm telling you. Ne'amana. I'm telling you this is 100% true. Guaranteed. Shelo yusku davar velo yudu klal b'shem sheichel obina zulasi piyav mekobol chacham ozim mekobol maven v'hasvara ben. Sorry, maven. Right? You're not going to get it right. Meaning, no matter what you do, you can be a mechutzav and don't listen to me and try and figure it out because you have such a tshuka to understand Torah deeply, which might be beautiful, might be misplaced. But no matter what you do, if you try and figure it out on your own, and it's not coming from the fact that you have Mesora of a Rebbe who learned from a Rebbe, 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 up to Moshe Rabbeinu of Kabbalah, or up to Gilui Eliyahu, Tirgitzchak Tzadi Nahar, or whatever it is, if you don't have that Mesora, then whatever you try and figure out is going to be wrong, no matter what. So it's not even like, don't do it because, you know, you're not supposed, I told you not to. Don't do it because anyways you're going to be wrong. So it's a fruitless, pointless endeavor by definition. V'hasvara b'hen, and not only is it going to be wrong, iveles machsheves, mo'eles rabas hanizakin. These things can be very dangerous for you. Mo'na'as hato'eles, al yom b'shav, okay, v'chule. That's what he says. Which is just, that actually comes up throughout the Perush al Torah. You know, the famous Rashi question, the famous midrash that Rashi quotes in the very beginning of Bereishis is, why did the Torah even have to tell us the whole story of Bereishis? Why don't you skip to the first mitzvah, right? Amar Yitzchak, right? Why did the Torah have to tell us this whole thing? You just skip to Achol Shezelachem? Now we're finishing up. So Rashi interprets that question as being, you know, we can start with the first mitzvah. What's the point in this whole thing? So we have the answer to, right, Koach Ma'asot Higid La'amo, right, that the Bnei Yisrael should have a response to the non-Jews when they want to take Eretz Yisrael, and they give no claim to Eretz Yisrael, v'chulei, not so important. The way the Ramban interprets that medrash, he thinks Rashi's wrong. The way the Ramban interprets that medrash, what's the question of Rabbi Yitzchak? What's the question of Rabbi Yitzchak? What's the point in the whole thing? I mean, what's the point in teaching us Ma'asot Bereishis? Start with the first mitzvah. So Ramban says, what do you mean, what's the point in teaching us the whole thing? We need to know about this for Emunah. Of course we need to know about Ma'aseh Bereishis. We need to have Emunah. If it started from the first mitzvah, we wouldn't have Emunah. That's the Ramban's question on Rashi. So he says, no. You know what Rav Yitzchak's asking? His question is, what's the point in putting it in Torah Shebichsav? Because if you don't have a Mesorah, you're anyways not going to understand what the Torah means in Torah Shebichsav to teach you proper Emunah. The only way you're going to get proper Emunah anyways is through a Mesorah. So what's the point in having it in Torah Shebichsav? That's this point, that's Lashitaso. Because he holds that these deeper things, you anyways can only know through Mesorah, you can only know the accurate version of through Mesorah. So what's the point in having it in Torah Shebichsav? Okay, so comes the answer and says, no, we put it in Torah Shebichsav because we need it to answer to the Gaon. Okay, but that's that. It's just, and you find this throughout. Whenever he brings in, he has like long Pirushim on a lot of things, and then he goes through Rashi and even Ezra and Kashas and Tirutzim and Gemaras and all these different things, and then he'll say Val Derech HaEmes, and he'll say a short little thing, and you won't understand it, and Zehu, and he'll say like, you know, the Dai LeYodim Chain or something like that. Chain, you know, might stand for Chachmei Nista, right? Chachmas Nista, right? So that's throughout his prayers. So that's just an interesting understanding of his Kabbalah, which makes it a little bit hard for us to actually do one of these Shiurim on the Ramban, because we're not going to understand what his. You know, philosophy was, we don't understand this Kabbalah, which was so essential to it, but we can't really, which is sort of the funny thing about trying to learn your Ramban, unless you actually have the Mesorah, which maybe we do, maybe we don't, in terms of these things.
Why can we learn from his teachers and his students that you said were not as Nisar as he was?
Oh, so we can learn from them, but
They can say, Levi Ramban.
Yeah, but then you don't know, because if they're publicizing it, it means they're not really listening to Ramban. So maybe they had, you know, maybe they had it a little bit wrong, or maybe not. Maybe you're right. It could be that they, you know, but Yesh Ladim. Meaning the point might not just be that you can't, that you shouldn't reveal it in mass, but the point might be that that if it's being taught through Torah Shebichtav, I mean through writings, in ways that actually speak out of lap, or it's being taught in mass, you know, dissemination, then by definition, you're not going to be able to understand it properly. Because by definition, something that's so nuanced and deep, which it requires much more personal attention and being taught in a specific way, as the Gemaras and Mishnayos talk about in Chagiga, about how these things can be learned. Okay? So interestingly, the Ramban, and we saw this in the Rambam, right? So we have this idea of esotericism everywhere, right? Everyone thinks there's deeper levels to Torah. So we'll just end off, my divrei chizuk for that, is to realize that in that, you know, I don't know, we're not getting to the Kabbalah of the Ramban in our whatever, but we should realize that, you know, this is an idea we're finding everywhere, that Torah is something very, very deep. Very, very deep. And I think that's one of the most important things to know, both in keeping our humility to thinking of what we can understand and realizing that kashas are very good to have kashas, but a kasha doesn't break the pshat. It doesn't mean that it tumbles underneath, because we are limited and Torah is extremely deep, number one. And number two, chizuk from this, is that we should always realize that there's another level of maturity to get to in our Jewish experience and Jewish knowledge. There's always another thing to uncover. We're never just like, I mean, we should be very proud of what we have and we should engage in it. It's awesome. But we should always realize also that as we move on and transition, so now we're developing a new layer of maturity. And like I spoke about before, people transitioning into a new stage of their lives. So this isn't a yerida. This isn't, you know, I'm leaving yeshiva and going somewhere else. Now I'm entering a stage that requires more maturity and more knowledge and more depth of Yiddishkeit. And the beauty is that Torah is so deep that as I keep developing, it will keep developing. I have to always pursue trying to keep developing that. Never thinking like, meaning as we get more, we have to realize that when we're 50, we can't have the same understanding of God and of Yiddishkeit as a 5-year-old. We have to keep developing and keep deepening our understanding and our maturity and sophistication of what we're doing. And I think that's something that really comes out of realizing the layers that the Ramban and the Rambam and all these people have showed us that Torah really has. These deep, deep, infinite layers of wisdom and meaning.